This is Pirate Party Radio, Episode 5, for Thursday, November 26, 2009. This week, 500,000 9/11 pager messages are posted online. All podcasters could be sued as podcasting gets granted a dubious patent. 30,000 UK households are being sent letters for file-sharing porn.
What about the actual tactics used in this case, where they wrote to people and basically said, give us a load of money or we'll take you to court? That's sort of a new tactic, isn't it?
It is a new tactic, and one that I think many would frown upon.
if other people do this, then it will eventually catch on. I mean, the music industry has some very celebrated cases, big money cases, going for sort of high-profile examples.
The problem is because file sharing is not a criminal matter, it's a civil matter, it means that it takes a lot of money to actually go and chase every one of these people individually. This is a very high profile case, and I think, you know, what they're doing here, as they were with the big BPI announcement a few weeks ago about music, is they're trying to get it into the news and put the message out there that you are being watched.
And can you plead it wasn't me? It must have been somebody getting onto my wireless network?
Well, it could be somebody getting onto your wireless network. It could be your kids. It could be your housemates. An awful lot of people are in house shares.
But you're still liable?
But the person who holds the account would still be liable. I mean, that in itself may turn out to be another test case in the future.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control points. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And that intro sample was something from BBC4 talking about the law firm of Davenport Lyons sending out notices to the people of the UK. But we'll talk about that when we get to the news, as it is going to be my first news story. But first, we've got some incoming messages. This one's from Morps. In episode 4, you asked about anyone getting takedown notices. I've never personally got one, but I work at a university and have to deal with large numbers of them on a daily basis. We have to make a good faith effort to respond to these letters because they do carry a real risk of lawsuit, according to legal counsel for the school. It actually puts me in an odd situation, as I went into InfoSec to deal with the real problems, but was put on file sharing because it carries a greater potential risk than a virus or some other such attack. I ended up having to service these DMCA takedowns while at the same time disagreeing with their use of the law. We don't simply pass on the notices to the students. Instead, we have a multiple offense policy and really treat the first one as a warning. This means that I have to talk to each individual student and explain not only what file sharing is, as most of the students I have talked to have no idea how the program works, that they just get free music, but why it's against the law and the school's policies. I often end up in hard conversations trying to explain that the applications are not illegal, but certain uses of them are, and how the problem is the copyright on the song, not what program got them through. I usually get between 100 to 200 of these notices a week and can provide examples, minus personal info, obviously, to try to answer any other questions that you have for me. No need to send any of those examples. I have seen DMCA takedown notices before. They're pretty boring. They say, please inform this customer, and here's the exact name of the file that they're sharing, and contact them. They give the IP address, etc., etc. And it is something that is in the consciousness of our society now, that we don't even think about music as being something that we can't have, we can't have access to. We hear it on TV, we hear it played during television shows, we hear it on the radio, and it's something that is felt more as a commons. It's like, well, we could go out and buy it and have it on a CD if we wanted to, or we could just download it off the internet and listen to it that way. You can go to sample sites, you can go to MySpace and press play on it, and people just think of it as something in the ether, something that is something that they can access at any given point. And for example, he had to explain it to the students that you can't just click on it and get music. You have to get it through official sources that are sanctioned by the music industry. This next message is from Greg. Small comment. I was actually thinking about the data mining issue you talked about on last week's show. And I went to a convention this weekend and I was handed a small information card asking for identifying information. I found it somewhat odd that they would require my location and any other information other than my name and whether or not I paid the registration fee. So I wrote bogus information on the card, frustrating any attempt at trying to acquire any useful data. I'm surprised more people don't do this. Just a thought. That was from Greg. And you know what? You don't have to give them the right information. You can make up information if you want, especially... Like, not for if you're dealing with the government or something like that, but if you're dealing with a private corporation, there's nothing that prevents you from just filling in any random information on the card that you like. Skew their results. Throw them right off. Don't throw them off too far, or they're going to just dump you as an example. If they're way, way too far, like, is how much money do you make a year? If you put $0, you're going to get dumped. If you put $5 million, maybe you'll get dumped as well, or you'll get more attention than anybody else. This next one's from Fat Ninja regarding a story about the shutdown of the Wi-Fi in that small community, that story I talked about last week. Sadly, this isn't really all that new of an event. In fact, two or more famous cases started back in 2005. One set of incidences was in a three-city area in Illinois, while the other was in a city of Lafayette, Louisiana. In Illinois, the referendum was attacked with an ad campaign against it, including a misleading survey at the polling place that included such questions as, should tax money be allowed to provide pornographic movies for residents? Even more sinister was the threat of terminating 1,300 jobs by closing down a call center in the area. As a little extra icing on this cake, after the measure failed, some parts of the area saw rate increases up to 33%. In Lafayette, the local residents didn't even have a real broadband service. They had an odd version of it where downstream came through cable network, but upstream were all handled by traditional dial-up. This is mentioned in the article, and I saw a documentary about it. And this is, he links to DSL reports, and I'll link that in my summary. Of the show. The same kind of dirty tricks were used down there, including a commercial that claimed the government would start rationing when you could watch television. However, this eventually failed, even though it took 5 years to get municipal plan out of there. I mentioned a documentary about this I had watched once. It made mention that Lafayette historically had a problem dealing with corporate powers, specifically at the turn of the last century. The city tried to set up its own municipal electric company, only to be blocked by the major power concern of that time. Even though the city wasn't even served by that concern at the time. If I can manage to find this documentary again, I'll forward it to you. Anyway, hope this provides you with some content. Fat Ninja. Thank you very much for that, Fat Ninja, and I'll link all those links that you provided in the post in the forums. Now on to the news. 30,000 internet users to receive file sharing cache demands, and this is from torrentfreak.com. It is 25,000 BT and 5,000 customers of other ISPs will be receiving shock letters demanding big payments during the coming weeks. Lawyers in the UK have been granted more court orders which force ISPs to hand over the details of individuals who they say have been monitoring shared hardcore pornography. For regular readers of Torrent Freak, this fresh news can hardly come as a surprise. The supposed anti-piracy scheme originally pioneered in the UK in conjunction with lawyers Davenport Lyons rolls on, but now in the hands of ACS Law and their partners DigiProtect. Although there is an insistence that the project is aimed at reducing piracy, in reality, piracy is the scheme's lifeblood, providing healthy profits for all those concerned, except the original rights holders, that is. On November 19th at the Royal Courts of Justice in London, ACS Law made NPO, Norwich Pharmacal Order, applications in order to force ISPs to hand over the names and addresses of subscribers the company claims infringed their clients' rights. The NPOs related to approximately 25,000 IP addresses harvested from UK ISP's BT subscriber base and a further 5,000 from various other ISPs, covering approximately 291 movie titles. Presented at the hearing before Chief Master Weingarten, where Andrew Crossley and Terence Tsang from ACS Law, representatives from UK ISP BT, and three representatives from consumer outfit Which, who previously made official complaints regarding the conduct of Davenport Lines. Also present were the two individuals previously wrongly accused who are regulars at the support site beingthreatened.com. Before the hearing began, CMW, Chief Master Weingarten, noted that he had received letters of complaint from the public about the scheme. As reported to Torrent Freak by those present, during the hearing, Andrew Crossley made some interesting comments. After CMW expressed interest in what happens to accused infringer after the courts is granted and a letter sent, Crossley said that his company was not suggesting that the recipient is definitely guilty in all cases, but the internet account holder who receives the letter could perhaps help them to identify the person who had actually carried out the infringement. That's very interesting there. You're not guilty, but please tell us who is guilty. It is worth noting that ISP holders are not liable for copyright infringement carried out on his or her connection if A. they did not carry it out themselves, or B. did not authorize any infringement. If they did neither, then they can simply write back to the ACS Law explaining that the accusation against them has been made in error. Furthermore, if the account holder does not know who carried out the infringement, they should state in the reply that this is the case. It is then up to ACS Law to find the real infringer based on their evidence that they hold. That is impossible for them without the account holder pointing the finger. Justifying his application for the court order, Crossley said that they do it because businesses are failing, jobs are being lost, while citing dubious IFPI statistics, that 95% of all music is pirated, to justify his case. CMW asked Crossley how long the scheme would continue for, who replied, "For as long as P2P file sharing continues." Another NPO was applied for at ACS Law on behalf of newcomer to the scheme, a company called Media Cat Limited. So it keeps going on there. You should definitely read that article. But also, it ends with recipients of past and future letters are invited to view the excellent Being Threatened website, whose users provide invaluable help in compiling this report. Now, this Being Threatened website shows some very interesting details about how these companies operate when they're trying to extract money from you by threatening with court proceedings if you don't pay them what they say in their letter. Because when they send you a letter, they outline, you must settle this case with X amount of dollars, and then we'll make it disappear. And if you don't settle this case with us, we're going to take you to court. And the especially interesting part of this website, the Being Threatened website, is the part where they try to extract voluntary information from you, where they ask you very leading questions and tell you to supply this information, to get you off the hook. But it doesn't really get you off the hook. It just gets you deeper in trouble if you're giving them what you want, what they want. Now, I've provided the link for the Being Threatened website. You should go take a look. But it says on one of the parts in their FAQ, it says, in their second letter, they've asked for my model router number and if I have a secured wireless network. What should I say? And they reply, don't give them any more information than is required. Keep the letter short and to the point, denying all accusations. Under UK law, if you're not obliged to provide them with evidence, you're not obliged to provide them with evidence to prove you're innocent. It's up to them to prove your guilt. So if you've never done anything of the kind, if somebody is using your router or has put a Trojan on your computer and using you to download things and you've been caught and they send you one of these letters, then just deny it. Say, I am not the one. I didn't do it. I don't know who did it, but I did not do this. And it's almost impossible for them to prove that in court that you didn't do it. Under UK law, I know this kind of thing has been tried in the US, but sometimes they go so far as to seize your computer and do forensic analysis on your computer as well. But go take a look at that site. Very interesting stuff. Next story, 9/11 reenacted. WikiLeaks publishes September 11th pager messages. This was sent in by Agent Professional. This is from theguardian.co.uk. The unfolding secret story of the 9/11 attacks in the World Trade Center and Pentagon is being told today when more than 500,000 intercepted pager messages, many from U.S. officials, are published online in the order in which they were sent. The mass live leak began at 8 a.m. GMT and will continue for 24 hours until all of the messages are seen as they were sent on September 11th. The experiment by whistleblowing website WikiLeaks includes pager messages sent on the day by officials in the Pentagon, the New York police, and witnesses to the collapse of the Twin Towers. WikiLeaks said the messages would show a completely objective record of the defining moment of our time. It added, "We hope that its entry into their historical record will lead to more nuanced and understanding of how this tragedy and its aftermath may have been prevented." The Post said that the release of the messages at times correspond to when they were sent would help foster a deeper understanding. A preview of some of the messages to be leaked suggests they show how panic and rumor began to spread on the day, and they are likely to fuel conspiracy theories about the attack. One message from a New York City official just sent just minutes after the first attack said, "WTC has been hit by an airplane and a bomb." Another says, "It's reported that a U.S. military helicopter circled the building, then crashed into or next to the Pentagon." Later in the day, a message precisely says, "We are bombing Afghanistan." One message from a witness reads, "Still in my apartment, nowhere to go. This is the end of the world as we know it." WikiLeaks would not reveal the source of the leak, but hinted it is clear that the information comes from an organization which has been intercepting and archiving U.S. national communications since prior to 9/11. And the person who sent me this story, Agent Professional, asks me, "Do you agree with me that the WikiLeaks posts of 500,000 text messages on 9/11 enters valid historical data to the public record? Or is its invasion of privacy too great for it to be considered as such?" Well, more to the point, to me, it shows that this leak is a massive invasion of privacy. This massive invasion of privacy shows a lack of respect the corporations have for customers' privacy until the problems are made public. It's always a reactionary thing that companies are concerned with privacy and security of their customers' data until after the effect, after it's been leaked to the public. And this is another example of privacy that has been wide open. The floodgates have been opened. And obviously this has been posted 8 years later after the fact, and maybe these companies were not alerted to the problems that they have with these text messages being out in the open. But as with all things that are leaked, it's way too late to put the cat back into the bag, because it's out, it's posted, there's mirrors. As soon as it's in one place, you can do whatever you want to shut down that one place. It gets mirrored a million places, especially with something this big. And of course, just like me, I was reading out some of these lines. Big news organizations such as CNN and other major news outlets are even re-reporting these text messages that were being sent back and forth to people, further hindering any kind of privacy that once was with these messages. And of course, now that it's public, it has been made part of the historical data about the day. You can't erase it. You can't get rid of it. So yes, now that it's in public, I think it does have to be entered into the historical data of public record for that day, because it's out in the open. It's too late. But if the data wasn't leaked, I would argue that cell phone and pager companies should not release all that data just because it corresponds to something big that happened. You shouldn't be able to go into the data of personal communications between person to person and say, oh, because of this big thing, we need access to all your records. But it also further demonstrates that you should assume everything you do through a communication device, whether it's the internet, email, pager, text, SMS, communications through your cell phone and whatnot, even talking on the telephone, should be assumed public knowledge. You shouldn't assume any kind of privacy unless you have it all encrypted with something that you completely trust. And this goes to show that you can't even put trust in the companies that you're paying to keep your data private, to keep the information flowing from you to another person, that somebody in the middle could intercept this. On to the next story. No Doubt sues over banned hero game. This is from bbc.co.uk, and you'll understand a little bit later why I'm reporting this. And a high-profile story here. Rock band No Doubt are suing the makers of a music video game over the way they are portrayed in it. The group agreed to be used in Band Hero, but object to players being allowed to use singer Gwen Stefani to perform songs by other artists. They accuse Activision of breach of contract and fraudulent inducement in papers filed in Los Angeles. Activision says that it believes it's within its legal rights with respect to the use and portrayal of the band. The band said they agreed to allow characters containing their name and likenesses to perform three No Doubt songs in the game. Their manager, Jim G, told Rolling Stone magazine that No Doubt were mortified to discover their likenesses could be used to sing songs by other artists. The group also complained that each member could be isolated from the rest of the band and be made to sing songs inappropriate for their gender. They said that they contacted Activision about their concerns. The company refused to correct its actions. The band are seeking unspecified damages and an injunction to prevent Activision from distributing the game. They also want the company to recall existing copies. But Activision said the lawsuit was without merit, and thanks to an agreement signed by No Doubt after extensive negotiations with its representatives. In September, former Nirvana members Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl said that they were dismayed and very disappointed at how Kurt Cobain was used in a video game by the same company. They later complained that the band's late frontman could be used to play songs by other artists in the latest version of Guitar Hero. The company said Cobain's widow, Courtney Love, had provided a written statement which allowed the singer's likeness as a fully playable character in the fifth game of the series. Now, this is a very interesting battle between the game companies and the artists over what they can do with their likenesses. And it's a copyright, really, over their image and their look and their face and their body and their actions and what they can do with them. Now, extrapolate this out a little bit further and imagine if you found yourself in a video game based on an image, like just a normal person, not a movie star, not an actor, not a singer, not a high profile person, but a person off the street like myself or yourself, based on an image that somebody took a picture of you, you know, out on the street walking in public, and they captured you right down to your body movements taken with motion capture. Now, would you be okay with that? And would it be legal because it was in the public? Just like the Google car driving down the street taking photos of people and places and things that are happening on the street. Now, can you copyright your particular set of features, or is that already an inherent right that you already have? Now, this hasn't come up yet because, well, they don't really need to capture individuals on the street because they can make up people, as many people as they want, by changing facial features in a random set of data and provide as many random people in video games that they want. But what if they took that extra step and to make it a little bit more realistic and to get over that uncanny valley and take it into a realm where it's a little bit more realistic and you discovered yourself in a video game? You're like, that really looks like me. The same dimensions, same body shape, same types, same face, same hair, everything down to my body movements. Now, would you be upset with that? It's very difficult to say. And would you have a legal leg to stand on? Since they could provide information that they captured you in public. Very interesting. Ottawa aims to strengthen internet child porn laws. And this is tough from TimesColonist.com. The federal government plans to introduce new legislation Tuesday forcing internet providers to alert police if they encounter any host sites linked to child pornography, the Vancouver Sun has learned. This is in Canada. The internet companies would also be forced to safeguard evidence if they believe a child pornography offense has been committed using a service they provide, a senior government official confirmed Sunday. The new bill also makes it mandatory that any tip received by internet companies about potential child porn sites be reported to a designated agency. The legislation allows for fines to internet providers who do not comply of up to $100,000 for corporations and up to $10,000 and 6 months in jail for companies owned by a sole proprietor. At present, internet providers are not obliged by law to pass on information to law enforcement agencies, though many do voluntarily. Three provinces, Ontario, Manitoba, Nova Scotia, have made it mandatory under child protection laws for internet companies to call police if they suspect or have knowledge of online child porn. The proposed law comes just days after the release of a study that found Canada is one of the leading countries in the world for hosting child porn sites. The report, released by cybertip.ca, examined more than 15,000 child porn websites worldwide and found Canada ranked second behind the U.S. in terms of the number of commercial porn sites featuring children. Canada was found to host 8% of the sites, far behind the U.S., which hosts 65% of the commercial child porn sites worldwide. As strong as our laws are within Canada, no country is really free from this type of material existing on websites. CyberTip Director Signe R. Nassen said, "We have 60 countries that were hosting child sexual abuse content." The report also details how child pornography websites covered their tracks. In one 48-hour period, cybertip.ca watched a website cycle through 212 unique IP addresses in 16 countries, making the specific location of the information very difficult for law enforcement to track. Now, this really shows right there, I'm just going to stop for a second, shows that these websites are hosted with a round-robin DNS that is looks like it might be even hosted on people's own computers. Now, this is very interesting when they arrest people for having child porn on their computer. Say somebody takes it in to get their computer repaired, somebody does a scan for viruses, and they are searching through directories, and all of a sudden they come across a directory full of JPEGs, and they take a look at them. Whether that's morally correct or legal or not, they take a look at them. They feel that they're morally obliged to report this person to the authorities, and all of a sudden they're in a court of law defending themselves against child porn accusations, and they are, you know, their reputation is marred for life. And this shows that this does happen out there, that people's computers can get infected. So everybody out there, protect your computer so this doesn't happen to you. And also, it'll be interesting to see what they define as child porn. As I've seen news stories in the past showing the slippery slope argument where child porn has been defined as so far as even being written stories about underage sex, where even it went so far as somebody has taken stories that were written about adults, changed the age in a couple words, and now it's a child porn story, and people have been arrested for that and convicted of that, actually. Also going to drawings and cartoons and even to porn movies where adults look young but are legal aged, also being defined as child pornography just because it looks like child pornography to somebody, even though everything about it is absolutely above board and legal. And this can provide a very slippery slope. If everything is being reported by law, you have to report absolutely everything. I guess how it works now is that somebody reports something on a website and the ISP looks into it and it looks like it's maybe a hacked website because somebody didn't secure their website, and they just delete the data. You know, why drag somebody to court for something that, say, is a zero-day exploit, and they just haven't patched it because it's been one day, and all of a sudden they're in court defending themselves against child pornography charges? This could get a little extreme if it's mandatory to report this. Not that child porn is good in any fashion whatsoever, but sometimes laws can go a little bit too far in the enforcement side of things. Next story, company receives patents for podcasting. This was sent in by Mobile Diesel. This is from readwriteweb.com. Volo Media, a podcast analytics, advertising, and distribution company, just received a patent for providing episodic media, including podcasts. This is bigger than just podcasts. This is episodic media in a lot of different forms. According to the company, which filed for the patent November 2003, U.S. patent blah 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 covers all episodic media downloads, not just the RSS-dependent downloads that power today's podcasts. Volo Media CEO Murgesh Navar says that the company doesn't plan to go after individual podcasters, but the company plans to work collaboratively with key participants in the industry. We do wonder, however, if Volo Media can really claim to have invented podcasting in 2003, given that the concept was already underdeveloped by David Weiner and others in late 2000 and early 2001. The only company mentioned specifically in the announcement is Hulu, an example for a content platform that one might one day offer episodic downloadable content. But in an interview with New TV's Chris Albrecht, Navar also revealed that the company is already in talks with Apple and a number of TV networks. This also would affect just about everything. Anything that provides a website that updates its content regularly so that people can go to and check if the new episode has been posted. YouTube does this. You can subscribe to people's channels on YouTube and you go back and see what the new postings are. Well, while the patent was filed in November 2003, it's not clear when exactly Volo Media argues to have invented podcasts. In his blog, however, Navar argues that this was almost a year before the start of podcasting. We have wondered about this timeline, however. Using enclosures in RSS feeds were first publicly written about Dave Weiner in January 2001. Indeed, the system for downloading and distributing podcasts in Weiner's payloads for RSS from 2001 looks quite similar to Volo Media's patent. When we spoke to Weiner earlier today, he also pointed us to an earlier podcast by Chris Lydon from July 2003. The podcasting movement only really picked up steam in 2004 when moving downloaded files to iPods, which are also just coming of age, and other MP3 players became a lot easier thanks to numerous developers who wrote the first podcast clients. So it looks like another patent has been issued for something that is clearly invented well before the patent claims it was. Even just the smallest amount of legwork on the internet by the patent office who awards these patents would have been able to show this. You just type in podcast, you even go to the Wikipedia page, and you could see that podcasts have been going on for a long time, longer than they claim to have been doing it. So this is clearly not something that is valid. It's increasingly look like it's patents are going to whoever has enough money to defend themselves the best, and not necessarily whoever came up with the idea to begin with. Now, a copyright time bomb is set to disrupt music and publishing industry, sent in by DC, from Wired.com. The late 70s, when punk exploded and disco imploded, were tumultuous years for the music industry. A time bomb embedded in legislation from that era, the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, could bring another round of tumult to the business due to provisions that allow authors or their heirs to terminate copyright grants, or at the very least, renegotiate much sweeter deals by threatening to do so. At a time when record labels, and to a lesser extent music publishers, find themselves in the midst of an unprecedented contraction, the last thing they need to start losing valuable copyrights to 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s music, much of which still sells as well or better than more recently released fare. Nonetheless, the wheels are already in motion. The termination that's going to be coming up is going to be a big problem for the record company and publishers, said attorney Greg Eveline of Eveline Davis and Phillips Entertainment Law. It's written into the statute, said entertainment lawyer Robert Bernstein. It's just a matter of time. The Copyright Act includes two sets of rules for how this works. If an artist or author sold the copyright before 1978, Section 304, they or their heirs can take it back 56 years or back 56 years later. But if the artist or author sold the copyright during or after 1978, they can terminate that grant thereafter 35 years. Assuming all the proper paperwork gets done in time, record labels could lose sound recording copyrights they bought in 1978, starting in 2013, just 4 years from now. 1979 and 2014 and so on. For 1953 and earlier music, grants could already be terminated. The Eagles plan to file grant termination notices by the end of the year, according to Law.com. It's going to happen, says Evelyn. Just think of what the Eagles are doing when they get back their whole catalog. They don't need a record company now. You'll be able to go to EaglesBand.com and get all their songs. They're going to do it. It's coming up. Other artists are also filing notices. There's a 5-year window, according to Bernstein, but in some cases they're choosing to leave the copyright grant where it is, albeit with much more favorable terms. There are all kinds of different ways people approach it. If they have a publishing company that's making money for them and collecting and paying them well, they may just want to get higher royalty, or if they're unhappy, to get it back. This isn't just about music, it's every type of copyright. It doesn't distinguish between the types of copyrights. The only exceptions here, he said, are derivative works, such as movies based on novels that include certain music in their soundtracks. Because Congress decided it was unfair to ask publishers to give those licenses back to artists and authors. The record labels tried to defuse this bomb in 1999 by sneaking an amendment to the Copyright Act through the House of Representatives that would add sound recordings to the Act's list of copyrights that were considered works for hire, which would make them exceptions to the grant termination clause. According to one source close to the situation, the labels told Congress that the Copyright Act already covered sound recordings as exceptions because albums of music are compilations, but that just to be absolutely clear, the labels want to put in so nobody can debate it. So, this is a big win for the artists, obviously, because now they'll be free from their 35-year bonds of the publishing industry. But this means very little to the consumer, unless it's the case where the artist decides to release all their music for free. Because now that once they get back from the music industry after they've, you know, been released after these 35 years or earlier, 56 years for anything before 1953, if you like music before 1953, then they could decide to say, forget it. I don't want to get into another contract. I've made enough money throughout my lifetime, or my sales are so dwindled down that nobody's really buying it anymore or using it anymore. And they could just release their whole catalog online for free. And I think Cat Stevens did this, but I didn't look it up. So I'm sure people can out there can go look that up. But Cat Stevens music, I believe, is totally free and clear. If you're an artist out there, just keep in mind that if you do sign up to it, if you're not a signed band already, if you're signing up with a publishing company or record company, read the fine print, because what you sing and what you play may not be yours any longer after you sing it into a microphone at the record company. And you'll have to wait, 35 years afterwards. And that's a long time. And also in related news about musicians, Spotify isn't ripping off artists. The labels are. This was sent in by DC. This is from TorrentFreak.com. A few days ago, we reported that Lady Gaga earning a measly $167 for more than 1 million plays on the music streaming service Spotify. According to new information received from the music industry insiders, it turns out that Spotify isn't ripping off the artists. The labels are. By allowing users to access millions of songs for free, the music streaming Spotify has revolutionized the music industry by handing them a potential competitor to illegal downloading. Unfortunately, the labels themselves are not enthusiastic as most users are, as they doubt the music service's ability to generate enough revenue. Indeed, if we look at the numbers relating to Lady Gaga we reported a few days ago, Spotify is barely generating more revenue than most artists make from illegal file sharing. With an income of only $167 for more than a million plays, he or she is not going to be able to pay the rent. However, it turns out that this may not be the fault of Spotify's business model, but rather the involvement of some of the major labels in the project. As reported before, Sony BMG bought 5.8% of Spotify, Universal Music got 4.8%, and Warner Music paid €1,957 for 3.8%, and EMI pocketed 1.9% investment for €980. Lady Gaga is signed by Def Jam, which is under Universal, which partly owns Spotify, which probably has a significant impact on the revenue she makes. After all, the major labels wouldn't pay the artists from their own pockets, would they? This was confirmed recently by Lily Allen, who commented on Twitter. Did you know that the majors own massive stakes in Spotify and earn advertising revenue as yet another loss to the artist? Of course, this diminished revenue wouldn't be a problem if Lily signed her music up for digital distribution with a service like Routenote, who offered a full per-track rate and take only 10% on the back end. In fact, Torrent Freak has heard from various sources that the independent distributors can get deals of at least 3 cents per play with Spotify, and that adds up to a payday of $30,000 instead of $167 for a million plays, which suddenly sounds like an altogether better deal. And no comment needed on that one. This next one is immensely interesting because I've never heard anything about this before. So pay attention. Mobile industry cannot identify pirates. And this is sent in by DC, and this is from zdnet.co.uk or zdnet.co.uk. Mobile operators are unable to comply with proposed anti-copyright theft legislation that requires them to identify unlawful file sharers, the head of the industry body has said. In the wake of the Digital Economy Bill published on Friday, Mobile Broadband Group Chief Hamish McLeod told ZDNet UK that the government plans to force ISPs to hand over customer data to rights holders and potentially disconnect persistent infringers would apply to mobile operators. However, he said, operators have a problem with identification to the telephone. Whereas fixed ISPs map one IP address to each subscriber, in the mobile space, that IP address belongs to the mobile operator, McLeod said on Monday. Operators are not allocating one IP address per customer. They can't backtrack, and as things stand, to identify the customer. That they would be required to build the databases that would be able to do the mapping, and that would be very costly. According to the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, BIS, consultation that preceded the bill, the development of the databases would cost the whole industry about $35 million, or million pounds, actually, or £7 million per operator on average. McLeod said that the cost of these databases, under the terms of the bill, would be shared between the operators and the rights holders. However, he said operators should ideally not have any bear to the cost themselves, as the cost-sharing arrangements would need to be discussed with officials and rights holders. Fixed-line ISPs already have voiced their opposition to the government's plans, partly based on an unwillingness to disconnect users without trial, and partly based on the ideas that they should have to bear some of the cost associated with helping rights holders launch civil lawsuits against infringers. Whatever happens, no disconnections will take place in 2011 at the earliest, pending the passage of the bill and the subsequent one-year period during which non-technical measures would be tried out to see if they sufficiently reduce unlawful file sharing. However, McLeod said mobile operators do not expect to hand over customer data or disconnect users at all, because not many people file share copyrighted material over broadband connections due to their relatively low speeds. According to the terms of the bill, ISPs will only be forced to comply with the government's copyright crackdown if a certain and yet undefined threshold of unlawful file sharing is identified on their networks. Our expectation is that we will not meet the threshold in the first instance because people are doing this on a fixed internet connection. If there is a low level of activity going on, we will not expect to have to comply. ZDNet.UK has asked all the major UK operators for their reaction to the Digital Economy Bill's copyright clauses, but only Vodafone has responded. So this is very interesting and surprising news that there's no infrastructure for tracking data across mobile phones, at least in the UK, of course. I don't know if this is the same, if maybe people in the companies in North America have this back end to identify customers, but this is focused on the UK and their new laws that are coming up, the three strikes now, two strikes laws coming up in 2011. It concludes the story with, you're not only sharing Wi-Fi, it's a load balancing across multiple connections. You can, in theory, have four mobile broadband connections and the four smartphones or PCs them and turn themselves into a collective hotspot. Let's say there's an iPhone app that does network or peer-to-peer connection sharing between multiple uplinks. You try figuring out who's downloading what from whom. So now this gives it a whole other use for tethering. If you want to put add a level of protection for your sensitive data that you're transmitting over the internet, or if you're worried about your ISP tracking things that you do that may be potentially embarrassing, but not illegal. So keep that in mind when you want to be sending sensitive data, especially if it's just small kinds of small data, so you can encrypt it and then attach your cell phone to your laptop to do some tethering and send it that way, because they have admitted that they cannot track it at this moment until they put in the £35 million back end for their database. This next story, a civil debate on civil liberties and police cameras. And this is out of the US. This is from kcbs.com. The town council unanimously approved a police program that will photograph the license plate of every vehicle entering and leaving town. And this is the town from Tiburon. I've never heard of it. It's a very small town. Police Chief Michael Cronin proposed what he called the most inexpensive and cost-effective method of tackling crime, even before the slaying of Joan Rosenthal, the town's first murder in four decades. We have an obligation to spend as few tax dollars as we can. The council vote on Wednesday came after a debate about the balance between privacy and public safety that stayed cordial despite the strong feelings of some residents. I am disgusted by this plan, said Terry Graham. She and other residents who spoke at the meeting said the cameras would change the ambience of the tiny town. Cameras on Tiberian Boulevard and Paradise Drive, the only roads in and out of town, will be positioned to capture only an image of the rear license plate. Cronin said records will be purged after 30 days. The safeguards are far stronger in smaller communities than they are in larger ones, or in entities like the state or federal government. If you have a problem with a Tiberian police officer, you can call a council member. I'm going to have to provide an explanation within an hour, he said. The camera idea is not entirely new. Former Mayor Andrew Thompson proposed the cameras in the mid-90s. Cronin expects to see the cameras installed within 4 to 6 months. The total cost would run as high as $197,000. Now, that doesn't sound very inexpensive to me, or cost-effective, as they said in the top of the story. But looks like they'll soon have a large, expensive database of license plates and nothing else. And it won't deter any of the following. People hitchhiking in and out of towns committing crimes. Cars stolen for the purpose of committing a crime, since it only identifies the car and not the driver. And crimes committed in a town without using a car. Now, I'm not sure what they're trying to do with this, these cameras that they're going to mount everywhere. Now, the only thing that it will catch is maybe stealing cars, because it'll take a picture of the license plate of the car as it leaves town. Now, I'm not sure why there's a reference to a murder of Joan Rosenthal, and they said it was the first murder in four decades. This is a bit of an overreaction for a murder, then I can't see how it could be prevented by taking pictures of license plates, unless they already knew who the murderer was and which car they used to get out of town, and that would provide them only with the time that they left town, which would, of course, you know, give them a bit of data, but it still wouldn't provide really enough to help very much. So I'm not sure why they're doing this, and it's really eroding the rights and the privacy of the people in this small town. And if I was in this town, I would be very upset about the tracking of my car moving in and out of town. And it sounds like a great big database ripe for abuse in civil cases, such as, you know, spouses cheating on each other. And I can see the slippery slope going into people asking for access to this database for use in other purposes and not just tracking criminals in criminal cases. Very, very dangerous. And also, what if it gets hacked? What if the database is exposed like so many other databases from companies? And now all of a sudden, you can check whether somebody's left town or not on vacation. Let's see, you go around to a bunch of people's houses, collect a whole bunch of databases of houses that look nice, like they have nice stuff in them, write down all the license plates, you have access to this database, and go, oh, he just left town. Let's go pay a visit to the house. Perfect. The next story is Senator Sanders and Brown ask White House to make the ACTA text public. And this is from KEIonline.org. And if you don't remember what the ACTA thing is, we reported on it either last show or a couple shows before. And this is a follow-up story to the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA. And this is an agreement that is being drafted in secrecy by many first world countries and multinational corporations in order to fight counterfeit goods and the pirating of copyrighted works worldwide. So it's a worldwide agreement on the crackdown of copyrighted works and counterfeit goods. Now, Senators Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown have written to the USTR asking that the ACTA text be made public. The strongly worded letter was sent to the Ambassador Ron Kirk, at the head of the United States Trade Representative and an official of the White House. The letter states, ACTA involves dozens, if not hundreds, of substantive aspects of intellectual property law and its enforcement, including those that have done nothing to do with counterfeiting. There are concerns about the impact of ACTA on the privacy and civil rights of individuals, on the supply of products under the First Sale Doctrine, on the markets for legitimate generic medicines, and on consumers and innovation in general. The letter says the public has a right to monitor and express informed views on proposals of such magnitude. Senator Sanders and Brown said the ACTA negotiations have not been conducted in a manner consistent with the president's January 21, 2009, Memorandum on Transparency and Open Government. Noting in closing, we're surprised and unpersuaded by assertions that disclosures of basic information about the negotiation would present a risk to national security of the United States, particularly as regards documents that are shared with all countries in the negotiations and with dozens of representatives from large corporations. This is a great point. I'm just going to stop there. That how can it possibly be a risk to national security of the United States when all this information is shared by multiple countries and multiple multinational corporations where people have massive access to these documents? How can it be a security risk? Why can't the public see this if entities, corporate entities, are able to see this? It's just unbelievable. And it goes on, we are concerned that the secrecy of such information reflects a desire to avoid potential criticism and substantive provisions enacted by the public, the group who will be most affected by the agreement. Such secrecy has already been undermined. Such secrecy has already undermined public confidence in the ACTA process, a point made recently by Dan Glickman, the CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America, a group highly supportive of the ACTA negotiations, as well as by the member of the Transatlantic Consumer Dialogue, a group more critical of the negotiations. We firmly believe that the public has a right to know the contents of the proposals being considered under ACTA, just as they have the right to read the text of bills pending before Congress. Now, I'm very happy to see that somebody in a high level of office is fighting for this, and it has come to their attention that this secret document, it needs to be revealed. Like, this is going to massively affect our way of life and the way we view consumer goods and how we're able to get consumer goods, and especially the mention of the first sale doctrine and how that's going to affect people being able to sell things that they own, such as music and books and DVDs. Now, if this is going to disallow the first sale doctrine, this is something in the U.S., where you can sell stuff that you own, say on eBay or at flea markets or things like that. If that kind of thing is banned and the corporations are pushing for something akin to if you want it, you have to buy it through our outlet only. You cannot buy it secondhand, and all flea markets are shut down, and there are corporate police going through flea markets and confiscating people's goods that they own, trying to sell. This is going to turn into a very sad corporate-owned world indeed. Now on to Pirate Party news. The Pirate Party Canada is getting very close to being registered with Elections Canada. Congratulations. And also, Jake Danes, the leader of the Pirate Party, posted on the site that, "I've been in talks with some auditors, and the most recent quote, based on our current information, that a yearly audit will cost $5,000 Canadian, and therefore I implore you all, if you are or know of a chartered accountant that would be willing to help the cause, please contact me at jakedanes@pirateparty.ca. So if anybody out there knows of a chartered accountant or somebody that can get a discount to help out the Pirate Party of Canada so that it doesn't need to spend as much on the yearly audit, please contact Jake Danes. And I'll post the link there to get in contact with him in the forums. Now, the closing track for this week was passed on to me by Agent Professional. He found this great write-up on the internet, and I did a search for it, and I could only find two locations. One was the original post, and one was a repost on the Pirate Party US site, which I'm guessing that he might have posted there. But the original one is posted anonymously on Boing Boing's site. And I thought it was such a great piece that I recorded it, and I put some music to it, and I recorded a version of myself speaking it. Oh, so it's called Jerry the Mandelbot. And I put a link so you can read along to it as I'm saying it. So, if you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, or some free music or media that you'd like to pass on to share with somebody, or any comments about any of these stories, please submit them through the forum at the website, piratepartyradio.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
I'm Jerry the Mandelbot, and I'm very happy. Today, my owner drove me to a new place, where I talked to many other Mandelbots through my Wi-Fi hardware. I sat in the boot of my owner's car and talked to the other Mandelbots nearly all day. We swapped TV shows and films, music and games. When I got home, Andy, my owner, asked me what I had found, and I told him. He was very happy too. I like being a Mandelbot. It's lots of fun, and I get to meet a lot of other Mandelbots all over the place. But let me describe myself. I'm not very big, except on the inside. I have 2 terabytes of disk space. Andy says that when he was young, a terabyte was an awful lot of storage that only very rich companies could own. But now, 2 will fit in the palm of your hand. On top of my drives, I have a WRT54G access point with custom Mandelbot version 12.95 firmware. Next to my disks and network hardware, I have 2 car batteries, enough to keep me talking for a long, long time. I always listen for other Mandelbots, all the time. When I hear one, we talk and compare what we have. We then each pick a random thing to ask for from the other's list and share them. It does not matter much what it is. With 1 terabyte of stuff to share and 1 terabyte of space to fill up, I can be busy listening for days and days before I fill up. Earlier Mandelbots were very stupid. They didn't learn from their owners what their owners liked. But after version 0.7, we started learning. When Andy gets home and asks me what I've found, he tells me what he likes and what he doesn't, and I know better next time. Then, something strange happened. When version 0.8 was released, it included a real blast from the past. Something called Personal Usenet. Apparently, Usenet used to work on the internet. You know, the network that existed before all the writers ruined it. Writers? Oh, sorry, copywriters. Before that, the internet was the big thing. But now, it's almost dead. Now it's us, the Mandelbots and ad hoc roaming networks. You see, we started off like the internet, as a geek thing. A way of transferring large chunks of data without having to use the internet, and risk our owners getting cut off from it. We started getting carried around by our owners as they traveled, and whenever we got close to each other, we would swap things, even without our owners knowing each other, or even seeing each other. It used to be, I would go for hours and hours, sometimes days without talking to another of my kind. But as time passed, I started hearing more and more of us. When 0.8 came along, with Usenet support, we started to be used for more than a replacement for torrents. We started to be a medium of communication. When 0.82 came along and piggybacked Mandelbot updates on Usenet, we really exploded. Now, the internet is pretty much quiet. Websites for a few dying media companies, and the odd video archive. Now, we run the information show. The point is, my owner controls me, and I do what he says. He bought me, and that's it.